Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Paul Farmer is co-founder of Partners in Health and chair of the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. His past book, Haiti After the Earthquake, was out a bit ago. His new book is To Repair the World. Paul Farmer speaks to the next generation. It has a foreword from President Bill Clinton, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Paul Farmer back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Thank you for having me back, Joe.
A delight to have you here. This is a collection of short speeches that you have given, and what brought you to put this work together?
Well, I realized I was spending a lot of time, especially in the past 10 years, teaching beyond the places I would usually teach, was in a medical school or a hospital teaching physicians, or teaching community health workers in Haiti and Rwanda, and of course learning from them. I was spending a lot more time talking to people as they were graduating from college or in college, and sometimes medical students with only passing interest in global health and social justice, and that I wanted to spend more time doing that because I have so much faith in this next generation's ability to get some things right that we've gotten wrong.
Why do you have that faith? What gives you that?
Well, probably some of it's due to just being middle-aged and thinking we better have some faith in the next generation. But most of it's from teaching, you know, from being around young people who are really interested in, again, problems that I think when I was their age 35 years ago or started medical school 30 years ago, I wasn't really as informed as this generation tends to be. That was my experience, for example, at Harvard Medical School. There were fewer of my classmates were interested in health disparities in the United States, global health, what we're calling now global health, the health of poor people in general, building up health systems, health safety nets. There just seemed to me to be fewer people interested back then in the early 80s than now. And so that's one of the reasons I have confidence.
You talk in this book about really challenging your audiences to counter failures of imagination, failures that keep people without access to health care and drinking water and schools and these basic human rights. And it's fascinating to think of it that way, of to engage the imagination.
You know, I've just seen the power of it as well. The reason it has to be a failure of imagination, I mean, imagining, for example, what I just saw in Haiti. I saw a CAT scanner in the middle of rural Haiti in a public hospital, which made me very happy. This is the hospital that we just finished with our Haitian partners. Now, why is that the first CAT scanner in a public hospital? Why is it the first CAT scanner in all of rural Haiti? And it's not because the technology doesn't exist and isn't portable. It's because it's difficult to imagine a future where that would be a standard part of a public hospital in any part of the world struggling against extreme poverty. In other words, it's not that we don't have the technology in the global economy. And you learn this early in medicine because, especially if you go, as I did, between Harvard and Haiti for 25, 30 years, you see on the one hand of that, the one end of that trajectory, you see a hospital that has the bells and whistles and tools and staff you need to take care of people. And on the other, you don't find that. And, you know, what happened the day of the Boston Marathon, there's a reason that no one who made it to a Boston teaching hospital died, and that's because these hospitals are prepared to receive trauma patients. And, you know, that's not at all what I have seen, you know, in Haiti after the earthquake or in a lot of the places in Africa where we've worked. Those systems, institutions have not yet been built. And as we know from trying to build them, it can be done.
And just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean that it can't be done.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. You know, the problem is that all of us become socialized for scarcity when we're working in settings of scarcity. And so you start to believe the arguments that it's not cost-effective or feasible or sustainable to do something that is needed to meet a social goal. For example, have high schools in every town, you know, public high schools where kids can go to high school or college. We called this hospital University Hospital, not because there's actually a university in that town in central Haiti, but because there ought to be. You know, it's a big commercial center, and there should be a chance for, you know, talented young Haitian kids to go to a university like I got to. So that socialization for scarcity is a big part of the problem, because it's what contributes most directly, I think, to these failures of imagination.
Was it slow for you to learn, or did it come to you quite fast in your work of the power of the partnership?
It was obvious from the beginning. In fact, you know, we called it Partners in Health 25 years ago when we were students, because we worked in, you know, a number of us met in Haiti in 1983, our Haitian co-workers, and also Jim Kim, who I met. It was at Harvard Medical School when I went to interview there. That's the year, it was 1983 or before that the founders met each other. And we just saw from the beginning that, working in Haiti, that there were things going on, like deaths from malaria or tuberculosis, or people not getting basic primary care, or really talented, smart people not getting a chance to go to primary, much less secondary school. There were enormous and are enormous challenges for health and human flourishing in Haiti, and as there are in other places in the world that don't have the resources and institutions yet to make that flourishing possible. So for me, that when I was 23 years old, that was the first time I saw it. And then we saw the power of partnerships with our Haitian colleagues who went and did things in places like squatter settlements, well, a squatter settlement in central Haiti. We went with a group of Haitian colleagues and they'd built a school there. And a squatter settlement, by definition, is a place where people go when they lose their land. So there are a bunch of shanties there, but no electricity, no water, and they built a school. And it was a nice school. And so that was a real lesson for me about the power of partnerships. And that's where we based our first clinic, which was later transformed into a hospital.
I found it fascinating in the book, because we talk about partnerships, we talk about the hard work and the dedication and the imagination to get things done. But you also talk about, and I'd like you to expand on it, the importance of hope and ultimately even faith. That how these play a very large role in this as well.
Well, when your subject of interest is disease and suffering and injury and sickness, which again, a lot of physicians, that's what they do. I also was interested in that as an anthropologist. When that's your topic, the idea is to change it. I mean, you wouldn't want a physician only interested in diagnosing misery. You'd want your physician to help you move beyond it. So the hope part is the hope, at the very least, that things could be better. And the, you know, faith as well, the faith that you know, there is no reason for people not to go to primary and secondary school. There's no reason for people to die of cholera or not to have clean water. Of course, there are roots to the ways in which water insecurity, food insecurity, or lack of health care are structured over time, but there's no reason it need be so. It's not intrinsic to the nature of being human in some parts of the world rather than others. So the aspirational part, the hope part, is a powerful antidote to these failures of imagination. At least that's what I believe.
And does that get you through as well as the patient and the village and the community?
Of course. I think all of us who do this work have a hard time facing suffering and grief and loss. I think all people do, not just those who are frontline providers. And you're going to have ups and downs just like anyone else. And knowing that you're working with a team where there are always those who are upbeat and hopeful is a very good thing. And knowing that that's always a resource that you have is if you're not feeling particularly hopeful, somebody in your team will be.
And you also address and help us consider the poor in Haiti and Rwanda and Russia and Peru and elsewhere and the social forces that ultimately determine who gets sick and who has access to adequate health care.
Well, I try to do that because I struggled so much with it as a young person. The discussions, for example, that you'd hear about, well, you know, someone is sick because he or she chose to do something. And then, of course, I'd see kids get typhoid. And, you know, what the next step was what? This kid died of typhoid because he chose to drink from a contaminated spring. So the exaggeration of agency, as some people would call it, you know, that means the ability to make choices, is something that you see very often in medicine and public health. But I was seeing in a lot of the places that I first worked, people whose choices were so sharply limited by poverty, displacement, you know, gender inequality, racism, again, these large-scale social forces, many of them tied to poverty, that were determining what their choices in life would be. And so I, you know, decided early on that I would try to figure out these what caused some people to be at such extraordinarily high risk of getting sick, while others were shielded. And you know, it's been very helpful to me as a physician and a member of the partnerships that we've embraced in our work to promote global health equity.
When it comes to humanity, when it comes to being humane, is that hardwired? That's not something you teach, is it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get too philosophical. I find in young people, including children, sometimes as you see, very often you see a sense of fair play and thoughtfulness to others, including others who are strangers. I see a lot. Now, that's not my that's not my area of expertise. I can tell you, whether it's hardwired or not, that I see it everywhere in the world, this ability to either be compassionate or to cultivate compassion. And, you know, yes, there are people who cultivate something quite different from compassion, but it can be taught, and more of the point, it can be learned. And you know, you can learn a lot about it over the years, about how to, and you could even structure, I think, compassion into systems, healthcare systems. You know, if you run up against a hostile bureaucracy as opposed to a compassionate care delivery system, you can figure it out quite quickly. And yet both the hostile bureaucracy and the compassionate care delivery institution are built by humans. So I think that we can do a lot more to make sure we have just and compassionate and systems as well.
The name of the new book is To Repair the World, Paul Farmer Speaks to the Next Generation. It is published by University of California Press. Dr. Paul Farmer, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks again for having me back, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, To Repair the World. It is published by University of California Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.